Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. We're in depth this hour with a discussion about politics and the military. But first, a perspective on the reaction in two different cities after black men have been killed by police. In Charlotte, city leaders are asking for calm after another night of protests. They've occurred in the wake of the police shooting of 43-year-old Keith Scott. In Tulsa, the family of 40-year-old Terrence Crutcher is asking why he was shot and killed when he wasn't armed and was clearly cooperating. And the mayor of Tulsa confirms that. David Thomas is with us. He's a professor of forensics at Florida Gulf Coast University. He's a former Gainesville police officer, and he joins us today from Gainesville, Florida. And David, welcome. It's good to have you back on the show.
Nice being back. How are you?
Doing all right. The circumstances of the Crutcher shooting in Tulsa, the Charlotte shooting of Keith Scott appear to be different, but something that connects the two is it seems that video is going to, again, be a key component in both, even if it is not as revealing as I think everyone would like it to be. How are you thinking about the role the video will play?
Well, we've talked about this before. It would just depend on how the video is set. Even when we looked at the video from Oklahoma, the officer said that he was reaching in the window, but later to come to find out that the window was never down. So that it just depends. It depends on the angle. It depends on so much.
What happens here, though, and I think we discussed this last time you were on the show, is a lot of expectation is placed on the fact that there is some video, and people draw different interpretations from it, don't they?
That is correct, and it depends on what you're looking at, and oftentimes it depends on what you want to see. It depends on whose video camera. If both of these guys have a video cam, a body cam, it depends on which body cam is picking up the footage. So it provides different perspectives. So all of that is relative.
Are you sensing that we're in a situation, perhaps, in these cities, as we've been in some of the other cities, where no matter what some investigation says, what the police say, what the city officials say, there will be a fair amount of distrust from a part of that community?
Yes, I would say in both instances, but I will say I give the chief in Oklahoma, I give him kudos for stepping up, you know, coming right and putting it out there. The issue in Charlotte is a little different because a year ago they had a shooting, and it was an unarmed ex-football player from FAMU University from here in Florida that was in an accident, and he was shot to death by an officer from Charlotte. And as that transpired after that shooting, I did some research, and I was able to find that the officer was charged. He went to trial, and four of the jurors were looking to release, let the guy go. Two wanted to convict him. There was a hung jury.
Wow.
And then what the state attorney decided to do was not to refile charges. So if you think about that and you see how that system works, how would you feel if you were a citizen on the other side saying, you know, we need to have our day in court and have it done properly?
All right. You said a moment ago, though, that you believe that the chief and I think the mayor of Tulsa deserve some kudos for the way they've handled this. What do you see that is affirmative there?
When I say that, they jumped around. I mean, they got right on the horn. They spoke up. They said, this is what we have. We're not, you know, give us a chance to kind of, let's go through the investigation. But I think when I see that and I don't see the people going crazy like they're doing in Charlotte right now, what I'm looking at is an organization that has a relationship with its community.
What are you noting about that? I mean, what are you actually observing that gives you that sense?
That you don't have any of the anything going on there. We're kind of just, the people have spoken, and they're kind of biding their time, waiting for this to play out, to give the city a chance to do what it needs to do. That says a lot. That says a lot about the organization. It says a lot about the relationships that the organization has with its community. Because if that means that they trust, there's some trust.
David, I wonder if you're also seeing evidence of, I mean, this has been, these incidents have been getting the kind of attention that they should for, it's probably been 2.5, 3 years now. Are you seeing evidence that city officials, police chiefs are learning from what has not gone well in other cities?
I would love to say that, but what our culture, meaning the policing culture, what we're all about is we tend to stand behind our own.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of negate, we don't want to hear what somebody else has to tell us. And so, you know, and so it's the blue wall of silence kind of thing. And when that happens, you know, it turns out you see what the end result, what happens with that result. And so that has to change. Some chiefs get it. Others don't. I remember last year I was with the Police Foundation. We were at with Jim Bierman, and he was speaking to some chiefs in New York, state of New York. And he told them, he says, guys, he said, this is a movement. And we need to get on board and clean up our house and do some things right in order for us so that we can get along, so that we can work with the people. And that was his advice at that meeting.
I was struck by something that Donald Trump said yesterday in reacting to some of the violence that's occurred in some of these cities, including in Charlotte. He believes that we should come back to a policing technique that I think was declared unconstitutional in New York. Listen to how he put this.
Okay.
I would do stop and frisk. I think you have to. We did it in New York. It worked incredibly well. And you have to be proactive. And, you know, you really help people sort of change their mind automatically. You understand.
Will you explain, David, actually what stop and frisk is?
Stop and frisk means that it's a tool that officers can use when they observe someone and this person is suspicious, what they appear to be suspicious. Based on that activity, it's far less than probable cause, but based on that activity and what they observe, what it does is allows them to stop somebody and pat them down for what would possibly be weapons or contraband. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But there has to be some activity associated with it. It's just not, I'm this lone black guy walking down the street, and the police pull up, and they snatch me off the street, and they pat me down. And what happened in New York is exactly that. And that was why it was ruled unconstitutional, because the numbers were just out of sight when it came to young black males and young Latino males.
I mean, the dilemma with what you're describing is perhaps, you know, the suspicious behavior is in the eye of the beholder. And we know how, you know, influenced that can be by unconscious bias, perception, all of that, right?
You're absolutely correct. And the thing that, and I've been reviewing some cases here in Gainesville, and some of the things that I notice is that what happens is people, what would be considered reasonable or articulable, because the words we use are reasonable and articulable. So we need to have articulable facts. You have to be able to put facts into motion to show that you had a reason to make me, to stop me. And without that, then you have nothing. There's no foundation for anything that you've done.
Yeah. Let me ask you, since we're talking about this, about a situation where maybe those facts, those articulable facts, are not especially clear, but when the police stop and frisk someone, they actually find, you know, drugs or a weapon. Does that then justify the decision to stop and frisk?
Some would say yes, but the rules say no.
Meaning
that if I have to be able to show the state attorney's office or the prosecutor's office, I have to be able to show them that I went through those steps. If those steps are missed, that means that you can arrest the person, but that means that on the other side of that, the state probably will not prosecute your case.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example. There's Fort Myers, Florida, in Lee County, that the two agencies have gotten together and they have a task force. I received a phone call from an attorney, and he goes, I just don't get it. He said, the state attorney won't file any of these charges.
Hmm.
I go, okay. And so I said, well, you got to kind of dig a little more. And he calls me back, and he goes, well, the officers are making stops, and they smell marijuana. I said, well, are they writing the citation for the traffic stop? He goes, no. Well, that citation is the foundation for everything else. That gives you probable cause to get to the car. That gives you probable cause to talk to the person. You see where I'm going?
Yeah.
It's built. It's a series of building blocks. And without that, down there, the state attorney is refusing to file charges.
David Thomas is with us if you've just tuned in. He's a former Gainesville police officer and a current professor of forensics at Florida Gulf Coast University. Talking with him this morning about what has happened in the communities of Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Charlotte, North Carolina, with shootings of black men, one unarmed. I think everybody agrees with that in Tulsa. There are disputes between the community, between the family of Keith Scott in Charlotte, North Carolina, about whether he had a weapon or not. And we've had several nights of protest there. Talking to David Thomas about training, police perception, wanted to get his thoughts on what Donald Trump said last night about stop and frisk. And a question here for you, David, from a listener who says, should we be looking at these shootings differently, given that the officers involved weren't white males, but a black man in one instance and a white female in another? And the white female was the police officer in Tulsa, I believe.
Right, right. No, the standard is the standard. And the standard applies to every officer, every person in blue or brown or green. And that is the standard that we all have to abide by. And so we shouldn't change that or mitigate it for just because of the fact of sexual orientation or the fact of race. It shouldn't play a role in it at all.
You know, I have to say, I was recalling when I learned that the officer involved in Tulsa was a woman, I recalled a different guest at one point saying that these incidents happen very, very rarely with female police officers. Of course, even when you take into account how many fewer female police officers there are on forces, that you just don't seem the same level of the use of force. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know. I don't know if there's any data, but I can. I will say that I would almost concur with that, just based on my experience on the street. Women. This is the one thing I'll say about female police officers, and this is the one thing I used to love when I worked with them, is that they have a way of talking to people. They don't have the brute strength, and this may sound very sexist, but the reality is they have a gift of gab. The majority of the female officers I've worked with over my 20 years. And it was really nice to work with them and to let them kind of talk, to smooth some of the things over, so it wouldn't turn into a wrestling match or a fight in order to make an arrest.
I don't think that sounds sexist. What you're telling me is they bring different communication skills.
Absolutely.
To these incidents.
Absolutely.
Heidi on Twitter says a friend wondered if Tulsa is responding differently because the officer is a woman. Will gender influence police accountability?
Again, I'll go back and I'll say exactly what I said before. The rules are the rules, and gender should not play a role in anything that any decision that is made. If she were being physically attacked and her ability to defend herself, that would play a role. But if we're talking in this situation where there's, you know, good 10 feet distance, and no, gender will not play a role in that.
David wonders, back on the stop and frisk here, whether police body cams make a difference in the stop and frisk conversation.
Okay, it depends. I would say that the body cams will play a role, but it also depends on the rules that the agency has in place with if the officers can turn the cameras off or do they have to leave them running all the time. If they're leaving them running all the time, then it's not an issue because everything that you do will be recorded. If you're turning them off, and you pick and choose when you turn it off and turn it on, then it could very well be an issue.
You know, I was trying to recall what you said. I think we did talk about body cameras the last time you were on. Are you in favor of departments should have them and police officers should just run them?
I'm absolutely positively in favor of that. And the only thing that agencies are stuck with is the infrastructure and the cost of being able to have the technology to be able to, you know, to download all the information. But it's a great tool because that tool means that there's no question if I did my job or I didn't do my job.
I was thinking about you as a college professor, and I know school's back in session, and I wondered if you're getting questions from your students about what's been happening in Charlotte and Tulsa and beyond.
I do, and what I actually do is I actually set my classes up so I bring in all of the latest reports. Like, so before the semester starts, I take all the latest incidents, I put them online.
Wow.
So we have an open forum, and then we get in the classroom, we'll actually sit down and talk about them, and we'll play the videos and go through them and tear them apart.
What have the students been saying about these newest incidents?
the students, from their perspective, it gives them a better understanding of what law enforcement goes through, but it also gives them a perspective of what people shouldn't do. Mm-hmm. They have a better understanding of the rules. And when they take the rules as they're taught and then they apply those rules to what they see, then they realize how, you know, the mistakes that are made, I guess, is where we're going. And so I think for me, especially with my kids, that look, a lot of those guys want to graduate and become cops. Mm-hmm. What I see them doing is that those are tools that they can take out when they graduate that they have an experience to draw from.
David, a real pleasure to talk to you again. Thanks so much for the time.
And thank you for having me.
David Thomas is a former Gainesville police officer, and as you hear, a current professor of forensics at Florida Gulf Coast University.